You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including dying Douglas fir trees in southwestern Oregon and restricting natural gas use in Ashland. I'm reporter Justin Higginbottom.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn. I'm the housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
News director Eric Newman is out today, but we're going to start with a story he published this week. The trees around Ashland are dying in the thousands, specifically Douglas fir trees. Eric brings us this story about how our changing climate is affecting forests in the region.
On a clearing overlooking Siskiyou Mountain Park in Ashland, a navy blue helicopter is making laps back and forth on the forested hillside. A long cable hangs down, and on each pass, the helicopter picks up three or four large bare trees.
They're shooting to get 20 loads per hour. Yesterday, they got 174 loads.
That's Chris Chambers, the Wildfire Division Chief with Ashland Fire and Rescue. He's helping coordinate this project where they'll thin around 500 acres. In areas of this forest, anywhere from 20 to 80% of the trees are dead, he says. Experts are calling it a decline spiral. Chambers worries it's increasing the number of dead trees that could burn in future wildfires.
There are many, many neighborhoods right at the bottom of the slope here at Siskiyou Mountain Park, and the vast majority of what is dead are right next to those neighborhoods.
He's also worried that a large wildfire could permanently change this forest if hotter temperatures driven by climate change make it hard for trees to grow back. He says this thinning work will help soften the blow.
This forest as we know it is going away. There's going to be a new forest in the next decade to two decades. If we don't stay ahead of it, then we might not have a forest in 20, 30, 40 years.
The work in the Ashland watershed is aimed at the symptoms of the fir die-off, but it doesn't explain why the trees are dying in the first place. On a trail just outside of Jacksonville, Oregon, Max Bennett is staring up at a collection of fir trees.
We've tagged these trees, little metal tag on the other side.
Bennett is a retired Oregon State University Extension forester. He's been researching this fir tree die-off, and he co-authored a 2023 paper called Trees on the Edge. As the name of his report suggests, this forest in Jacksonville is an environment that's right on the edge of where Douglas fir trees can grow. That means it just takes a little change in conditions, like drought or hotter summers, to push them over the edge.
Those two things, sort of not as much rainfall and higher temperatures, particularly in the summer, are what people are talking much more about now as hotter drought. So it's not just drought the way we normally think about it, it's hotter drought.
That combination of above average temperatures and below average precipitation is stressing out Douglas fir trees. Bennett suspects these conditions are messing with trees' ability to pull water up from their roots.
The hotter it is and the drier it is, the more draw from the atmosphere. It's like a straw. You're sucking really hard on that straw, and instead of liquid, you draw in air. And then it's like, you could think of it as a tree heart attack in a way.
Southwest Oregon is being especially affected by this hot drought because there's so little water here to begin with, he says. If hot drought is the first factor driving the die-off, the second one is a little metallic green bug.
I usually try to make a square.
On a hillside midway up Wood Rat Mountain in the Applegate Valley, Laura Lowry swings an axe into the bark of a standing dead Douglas fir tree. Lowry is an entomologist for the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. She's trying to look under the bark to find the squiggly tracks of an insect called the flat-headed fir borer.
Okay, here we get somewhere.
She rips off a square of bark. Inside are little tunnels where the insect's larvae have chewed. On the outside, tiny jewels of pitch or sap show where fir borers went in and the tree tried to stop them. These bugs aren't inherently bad.
They are more of the cleanup crew, and so they're not tree killers themselves. They're just more of like trees are dying and now they're helping recycle them, turn them into soil.
Lowry says fir borers actually smell stress signals from trees that don't have enough water. But now, with so many dead trees around here, the beetle population has exploded, even overwhelming healthy green trees. Before Oregon, Lowry worked in Idaho in the Rocky Mountains, where she studied other types of beetle outbreaks. She says they went in cycles. The outbreaks would grow, then peak, and then crash as predators caught up.
Here, we don't get a sense that this outbreak is crashing.
Lowry has done surveys across southwest Oregon. She says when she moved here just 4 years ago, there weren't nearly as many stands of dead trees.
We're like, wow, it's very fast. It's real time, watching the effects of climate change in real time, which is an odd feeling, to say the least.
In response to the fir die-off, the BLM is doing thinning on 5,000 acres in its Medford district, which officials say is to protect communities and roads. They're planning to cut down trees, some of which will be sold, and they'll do prescribed fire operations. But some Rogue Valley residents say the BLM and the city of Ashland are motivated by timber sales, not forest health or public safety. One is Luke Riediger. He's a longtime Applegate resident.
One of our contentions is that what they're calling hazard tree removal is starting to look, feel, and function much more like unit logging and much more like broad-scale clear-cutting than clearing hazards adjacent to the road.
Riediger says these beetle-killed trees would be better left as snags for animal habitat like birds that eat fir borers. And he says these same areas have been thinned in the past. He believes more aggressive forest management now will make them more vulnerable to drought and beetle mortality in the future.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that right now the areas being targeted for salvage logging are also some of the areas that have been the most heavily managed by the BLM, by the city of Ashland, and by the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest.
A better way to protect communities, he says, is to help residents who live around these forests create defensible space and take steps to harden their homes from fire risks. 5 miles north in Central Point, Brian Riottini is standing in a big green grid of Douglas fir trees in the middle of a farm field.
So this block is Oregon Cascade Low, which makes sense. This is around where we are at locally.
He's at J.H. Stone Nursery. Riottini is a geneticist with the Forest Service. The trees here are examples of Douglas fir that have been cultivated from different sources across its range. The grid is part of a project to study climate adaptation so land managers across the West Coast can help forests withstand future climate scenarios. He walks into one section where the firs are not looking great. They're scraggly and stunted. Some have gone from green to orange.
Washington Coast. A very different environment, and as you can see, they're not doing very well here, are they?
Even within a single species, like Doug fir, he says, there's wide genetic diversity. Fir trees that are adapted to the Washington state coast are not suited to southern Oregon, but others from warmer climates might grow better here as temperatures increase.
By transferring seeds from those environments that have adapted to those conditions to where those conditions now exist presently, we can essentially help trees track climate change.
They might plant seedlings just 1,000 feet higher in elevation from their original source. They're trying to mimic how trees would naturally shift, he says, if climate change wasn't happening so fast. The bigger goal for Riottini's team is to help land managers plan ahead for when forests like those in Ashland or the Applegate Valley get replanted.
I think we have our work cut out for us, for sure. I think we're behind, and things like the Douglas fir decline spiral are examples of that. But I am optimistic that we are going to be able to maintain healthy forest populations. It's going to require a lot of thinking and a lot of effort and a lot of innovation. But yes, I absolutely think that we can accomplish that goal.
In the years ahead, he says, they expect to see changes to tree species ranges. Douglas fir trees in southern Oregon are just one example where the effects of climate change will slowly be revealed. I'm Eric Newman reporting.
Roman, let's turn to you now. You reported on an Ashland City Council meeting on Tuesday night where council members moved forward with a number of proposals to electrify the city. What is electrification?
Electrification is not like the past where we were just bringing power into homes. What we're talking about here is really a ban or restriction on natural gas in the city. So electrification here refers to using electric-powered appliances rather than natural gas, for example, an electric stove or oven or a heat pump instead of a gas-powered furnace. So the goal is to reduce the city's carbon emissions. For those who don't know, natural gas is around composed of around 80% methane, and methane contributes to global warming at a rate 80 times more than carbon dioxide over 20 years. So it contributes a lot more to global warming. And burning natural gas in your home also produces what's called nitrogen oxides. These are pollutants that both contribute to climate change and they're bad for your health. Studies have shown that these pollutants are linked to increased childhood asthma. They can affect pregnancies and can have effects on your heart and lungs. So the city has kind of been looking into these electrification ordinances since March of last year after a student-led team from Rogue Climate has been showing up and pushing for this a lot because of, you know, these health effects, the impacts on greenhouse gases, and, you know, wanting to make a change.
And can you tell us about the proposals the city is going to start looking into?
Yeah, so there are three that the city decided to move forward with. The first is an emissions ban on two different appliances. So this would ban furnaces or water heaters from emitting more than a certain amount of nitrogen oxides. So that would essentially ban the use of natural gas-powered furnaces or water heaters. This is based on a similar proposal in the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, which covers San Francisco. And so this would apply to new residential home construction, not existing homes. The second is a new idea called a carbon charge. This would basically be a fee for people building a new home that choose to install natural gas lines instead of using electric. We don't know what that fee would look like right now, but it would basically be charging people upfront for their environmental impact by using natural gas. And that money would be used to mitigate those effects later. The third idea could actually have impacts on current natural gas users in the city. So they're going to be looking at modifying their franchise agreement with Avista, which is the company that provides natural gas here. That's something they'd have to notify Avista about in the first part of next year, and then the new agreement would take effect at the end of 2025. So a couple of changes they're considering right now would be increasing the city's franchise fee. That's a fee that the city charges Avista for natural gas use. Right now it's 5%. They've been talking about maybe 10%, doubling that, which is what some other Oregon cities have done. And that would mean that natural gas customers would pay more for their usage. They're also looking at other things like banning new natural gas connections in the city. And one interesting thing I saw is requiring that Avista share its data with the city about natural gas usage. According to Brian Soule, the city's climate committee, they haven't had recent access to data about how many people use natural gas or how much is being used in the city. So it kind of makes it hard to tell how their proposals will work.
We do know that in Ashland, our community natural gas use went up 10% between 2015 and 2020, and community gas meters went up 5% in the time frame. Avista has not been forthcoming in sharing that data since 2020.
So electrification is not a unique concept. Lots of other municipalities across the U.S. have passed their own forms of natural gas bans. How is Ashland's different from those?
Yeah, well, I think some of them are pretty unique. You know, the emissions ordinance hasn't been implemented in Oregon before. And according to city staff, they haven't seen anywhere in the country with this what they're calling a carbon charge. So some of these could be pretty groundbreaking in terms of restricting natural gas usage. A lot of places have implemented these. According to them, 109 U.S. jurisdictions, most of them in California. But we've also seen a lot of pushback from natural gas utilities. So I think city staff are spending a lot of time looking at what they legally can achieve to avoid a fight with Avista and avoid putting it to a citywide vote, which is what happened in Eugene and forced the city council to pull it.
So what are the next steps in this process?
Yeah, so they're going to start drafting the ordinance. They'll draft the two ordinances, one for the emissions restriction and one for the carbon charge. We're not sure if they pass one of those or both of those. And then they're going to start looking into changing their agreement with Avista. So we'll see what happens. Residents who spoke in support want them to bring this back pretty quickly by mid-June next month. So we'll keep an eye on things.
Well, thanks, Roman. Jane, very quickly, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland announced its 2025 season lineup this week. What's on that list?
So the theme of this upcoming season for the 2025 season next year is homecoming, which is partially because their artistic director, Tim Bond, came back last year. He had previously been the associate artistic director for 11 seasons. But they also want the community to come back. They want audiences to come back who might have been holding back because of COVID. So they want to get everybody back to OSF. So there's 9 9 shows on the list. There's Shakespeare's Julius Caesar with an all-female and non-binary cast, Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, the storybook musical Into the Woods. Tim Bond is going to direct his first show since returning to OSF, August Wilson's Jitney. There's Shane, a classic Western adapted from a novel, Fat Ham, a Southern fried take on Shakespeare's Hamlet, As You Like It, Quixote Nuevo, which was written by OSF board member and playwright Octavio Solis, and Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor. So there's a full slate of shows coming to OSF next year, and tickets will go on sale for the 2025 season in November.
Thanks, Jane. Well, that's it for this week's debrief. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.